After he had encountered God, Fat developed a love for him which was not normal. It is not what is usually meant in saying that someone loves God. With Fat, it was an actual hunger. And stranger still, he explained to us that God had injured him, and still he yearned for him like a drunk yearns for booze. God, he told us, had fired a beam of pink light directly at him, at his head, his eyes. Fat had been temporarily blinded, and his head had ached for days. It was easy, he said, to describe the beam of pink light. It's exactly what you get as a phosphine afterimage when a flash bulb has gone off in your face. Fat was spiritually haunted by that colour. Sometimes it showed up on a TV screen. He lived for that light, that one particular colour. However, he could never really find it again. Nothing could generate that colour for light but God. In other words, normal light did not contain that colour. One time, Fat studied a colour chart, a chart of the visible spectrum. The colour was absent. He had seen a colour which no one can see. It lay off the end. A short excerpt there from Philip K. Dick's novel, Valis. This is going to be a tough novel to review, to talk about. Once again, I'll probably focus on it as an object of literature, what it's trying to do, more so than the synopsis and the plot, which I'll go over. But there isn't too much there. I mean, there is this narrative, but it's intertwined in one of the most interesting ways. And I think before you know, I jump into the weeds here, what I would describe this novel as is an entry into what madness and irreality and irrationality of existence can be like for a moment, and it certainly leaves a trace as well. One is given a glimpse into insanity, into a form of insanity that is constantly finding its own reason and rationality, and in a way justifying its own existence, in a very intellectual and a very theological, but also a very, in a way, new age way. It's bringing together all these different times and different ways of being into something that constantly you are, as the reader, questioning, because the author is also questioning himself the whole time, questioning his own experience, and sewing together fiction, fact, reality, irreality, and then from that, sanity and insanity. I'll begin with the synopsis. So before I get to the background of the novel, it's a 1981 novel by Philip K. Dick, who many will know possibly for Valis. It's one of them. He's more infamous, but mostly I think people would know him as the guy who wrote the book that inspired Blade Runner. So he wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which then went on to be the book which Blade Runner is based upon. Valis is near the end of his career, you know, deep into his own sort of madness. So the synopsis, I mean, you know, the plot in a way doesn't interest me too much. I've got a lot of notes on this book. But what interests me more is something that happens, something that is given at the end of the novel, which is a overview in a way. It's the appendix, the Tractatus Cryptica Scriptura, which is in a way a factual, in the sense that it's a factual, mystical, Gnostic document given by Dick at the end in relation to what we've just read, which is supposed to be, in a way, fiction. And this is what really interests me the most about this, is the intertwining. I mean, for those of you that have looked into the work of Nick Land, that people will know I've written a lot on, what I would also describe this novel as is an exemplary text in relation to the notion of hyperstition, of fictions becoming fact, of fiction itself entering into the real, entering into what we consider to be the real, the factual world. It's the outside coming in. And when we move from the novel, from the narrative, from the plot, into that appendix, which is the Tractates on Dickian Gnosticism, which I'll get to, that is the hyperstitional leap. The hyperstition is happening throughout the novel also. Anyway, so Valis, what is Valis about? There isn't too much plot in a way. I mean, it's very, it's a clear plot. There is characters there. Dick, Kevin, David, Fat, which is an alter ego. Horse Lover Fat is his full name. There's characters there. I don't specifically or particularly think that one would connect to them in any specific sense. I think if anyone's going to connect to anything in the novel, it's the splitting of character. It's the breaking of selves constantly. But anyway, during the 1970s, a man by the name of Horse Lover Fat, which is Philip K. Dick, the real-life author's alter ego. So it's Philip K. Dick knowingly Philip K. Dick, the author of the real book Valis, writing his alter ego, Horse Lover Fat, into a story which is a version of events which happened to the real Philip K. Dick. And he is knowingly doing this. So there's these layers upon layers upon layers of a sort of metatextual and a self-acknowledgement of the splitting of the self in relation to what these events meant. In the 1970s, this chap called Horse Lover Fat has a strange experience in which he is bombarded by a pink beam of light. Basically, he then spends years of his life trying to work out what happened to him. The bulk of the novel, in a way, is following this, is him throwing out theories of what exactly this could be with his friends, Kevin and David. We are also, throughout the novel, given glimpses into Horse Lover Fat's unsuccessful attempts to save Gloria, who is a suicidal and she is suicidal, and also someone else called Sherry, who is terminally ill after the aftermath of Horse Lover Fat's own suicide attempt. I mean, the whole thing is steeped in an atmosphere of being unwell, of wanting to leave, and yet there being enough palpable intrigue in the world, which is almost disgustingly unstable, that one would wish to stay around. Eventually, the four of them go see a film called Valis, which seems to sort of bring together and justify, in a way, the experience of the pink light which Horse Lover Fat, Philip K. Dick, had in 1974. They then go meet the filmmaker of this film called Valis, which is then the title of the book. So once again, fiction and fact intermingling. A chap called Eric Lampton and his wife Linda. And they both claim to be beings from another star. They also claim that their two-year-old daughter is a savior in a line that includes Elijah, Jesus Christ, and a few others. Then, nearing the end, Horse Lover Fat and Philip K. Dick, or Phil Dick, realise that they are one individual, not two, and the three, everyone sort of returns to their homes, whereupon they learn that the saviour has died, and then Phil Dick sort of makes it his... this is intertwined with his understanding of Gnosticism, and Horse Lover Fat, or Phil Dick, you know, this divided self, to use the term of R.D. Lang, in relation to sort of schizophrenia, then... sort of goes on a journey to try and find the next in the line of this sophiological lineage in relation to what is titled online and is titled by Philip K. Dick fans as Dickian Gnosticism. So, I mean, that's the plot. And I mean, it's a relatively simple plot. One thing I would point out, which actually interested me in a literary sense, which I don't think has been spoken about too much, is... when we, before even delving into the Gnosticism and the madness and the insanity, there is something to behold in relation to the sincerity and the humility of the text. All the while, Philip K. Dick, as the real-life author, writing as himself, as Horse Lover Fat, who is consistently always trying to find himself and eventually understands that he's one and the same, there is a humility in his understanding that he is mad. I mean, this is a character, and of course a real-life person, who is spending time in mental institutions, taking a lot of drugs, and also all the time trying to define whether or not it's reality or irreality, or whether or not his experiences are simply just madness, or are they actually something to do with communicating with God? And the reason that I think, the other thing that I want to bring in is that early on with Horse Lover Fat, he's attempting to save this suicidal woman called Gloria. And for me, this is a reference to Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, where the protagonist of, and one of the key points of that novel, is that you have a protagonist who himself is, in the underground, in the abstract underground, in the underworld, in a way, is in the base desires, is in the lower self, is in the murk, is in the swamp, is basically defined and put in a position of someone who should not be helping someone else. And yet it's someone who emphatically should not be helping someone else, who has made it almost the meaning in their life to try help someone else, right? And they're completely not in the position. They need to sort of save themselves or help themselves before they can do this. And it becomes a case of the blind leading the blind. That's putting it very simply. But we see this same thing mimicked, a form of mimesis, which is something that Dick himself is mentioning throughout Valis. We see this Dostoevskian bind of someone attempting to help someone else who is in the same swamp, abstractly put, as they are, with this of Horse Lover Fat in his own insanity attempting to help Gloria, in usually in a fairly non-helpful way, and it ends up in a sort of recursive a whirlpool where both of them, nothing good is going to come of this. And that Dostoevskian point of, I guess, to use the Dostoevskian reference points of someone in hell trying to help someone else get out of hell when they haven't really had the impetus or the will to do it themselves, is transformed by Dick into a modern setting where psychedelics, drug use, and information is thrown into the mixture to make the whole thing move away from more medievalist conceptions of individuation towards more modern conceptions where reality itself becomes completely split. So it's less a case of trying to move out of hell. It's someone, which in a way this seems more terrifying, it's two people in irreality, in insanity, trying to actually, well, one of them trying to help the other one out of insanity into sanity. And you can only see that from the perspective of insanity, it just becomes, once again, this horrible recursive thing where how would you know when you've broach through to sanity, through to the real, and this is one of the problems. I mean, you have a group of people who are all caught in the same caustic quagmire of their own madness, and madness itself in this novel isn't derided. Philip, as I said, there's a humility around how Philip K. Dick treats himself and treats the alter ego as someone, well, maybe this is just schizophrenia, maybe this is just plain insanity, and I haven't actually spoken to God, you know. And it's that humility which actually allows the reader to stick with it and opens up questions which are far more interesting, because if it was just a double down on the experiences, it might come across as just another sort of two-bit pulp paperback of someone's crazy experiences in the desert or something like this. But there is, once again, this humility and this acceptance. So move from that so-called fictional synopsis, fictional plot of the, you know, once again, book as an object of this book, Valis, moving through from that fiction through to the fact, which is in February and March of 1974, Philip K. Dick, you know, the man, the real corporeal author, experienced a series of visions and strange phenomena, which were like this. It was to do with seeing the Jesus fish and then having this pink light. And he then explored the philosophical implications of this for the remainder of his life, really, in a journal which ran to, I actually think now, the total is 7,000 pages, which is called the Exegesis of I'm not sure how to pronounce that. My apologies. The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick, which now is available in an abridged form, and the abridged form is still almost 1,000 pages. Now we might think that from this this 7,000 pages, or in the abridged form, 1,000 pages of notes, that Dick came to some conclusion regarding his experiences. Well, people who've sort of studied the entirety of this thing from my research will sort of openly admit that the whole thing is still a process of becoming, a process of individuation, a process of finding out. There's no set conclusion, really. I mean, I'll get to the Dickian Gnosticism in a bit, but anyway, the relative conclusion that he comes to, the leading hypothesis of this 7,000-page document, which, you know, this novel, I'm really fragmenting this conversation all over the place. This novel, Valis, is part of the Valis trilogy, which is Valis, The Divine Invasion, and The Transmigration of Timothy Archer. And then the first novel by Dick about the Valis concept was titled Valis System, all one word, which was then published as Radio Free Albemuth after his death. He died in 1982, and then it was published in 1985. So, I could have got those the wrong way around. Sorry, time is splitting and time is out of joint all over the place here. There's a lot of like factual details to hold together. Anyway, the point being is that when we have the Exegesis, we have Valis, we have the other novels, all within this framework of coming under the factual happenings of Dick's life regarding these Gnostic visions, these visions of God, this relationship with light, with this pink beam, with Christ, and with other things. The leading hypothesis from Dick himself being that he was contacted by a transcendental mystical mind he called Valis, which stands for Vast Active Living Intelligence System. So then in 1976, completes a novel based on these so-called 2374 experiences in March 1974, the Valis System novel. And then all this goes through and spirals out into now that we have the Exegesis, we have all the other novels. So what to do with this is very difficult, because this isn't the whole story. This is a fictional part, or a fictional retelling of a factual event, which is why I would go back and re-emphasize what I said right at the start about approaching madness, is that this is an author who very transparently is, via one novel, attempting to work out something that happened to them via transfiguring themselves, their self, whoever that might be, into an alter ego, to then allow some form of splitting and some form of understanding throughout the text, which then becomes healed. The cornerstone, I think, a cornerstone to begin with what is the key similarity between the fact and the fiction, is something we see in Jewish humor, and something we see in a multitude of holy books, if not, symbolically speaking, all, and I take that with a huge pinch of salt, of course, but let's just say a multitude of holy narratives, or sacred narratives, which is that at a certain point in time, everything was in an equilibrium, everything was fine, everything was how it should be, everything had the balance, everything was Edenic, there was a relationship with God. And the key point being, something happened. There's, you know, if we think of the Old Testament, we have the fall of man, and going through to a newer work, if we think of something such as George Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, you know, there's been a splitting and it needs to be healed, right? Let's put it abstractly. There has been a rift. It needs to be healed. Something has happened. Some problem has happened that now this needs to be healed so we can go back to that Edenic state. Theologically speaking, people can argue around what the symbolic figures are of this, what the gods are of this, what the beings are of this. What Dick is doing is, or at least his experiences, once again, transforming this into the modern day. And that rift, that problem, becomes the split between the two, the alter ego and the reality, and in itself becomes the mental illness and the trauma itself. This splitting of the subject, of trying to figure out what has happened to the self so that one can have a sacred relationship with God once again and move away from two Dickian concepts, which I'll get to, which is the empire never ended, and the Black Iron Prison. And so when we move through to this question of what is reality, we have to touch upon, and this is why I'm not focusing too much on the plot, because the plot is used as a device to enter someone into a questioning of questioning of what we even deem reality to be, a questioning of the phenomenal world, and moving someone into a discussion regarding those in terms of that dualistic split, irreality, reality, sanity, insanity, self, unself, or maybe ego and self, questioning that split as to where that's come from, who's defined that, and what it is in that, what that splitting is. This really seems to be the fall for Philip K. Dick. And so Dick's Gnosticism, I don't particularly see as too far from general concepts of Gnosticism. So I will begin, and I will say I'm absolutely indebted here to a site called DickianGnosticism.wordpress.com, which I'll put a link in the description below, who've really compiled the key elements of this to help someone understand how it differs, what the basics are. But these are the 10 major principles of the Gnostic revelation. That's the title to begin our understanding of this Gnostic revelation, which is happening in Valis as a fictional text, to try explain what is happening in the reality. So we have to enter into the irreality, the madness, the tumult of Valis, the novel, to begin to understand reality, right? You have to have a relationship with this intrusion, with this trauma, with this splitting, with this rift. For Dick, it's an intrusion. It's the parasite of the demiurge, in a way. You have to have a relationship with what that reality is to then begin to define reality, and that once again becomes a recursive thing where you can understand one from the other. So the 10 major principles of Gnostic revelation, I guess a good way to title that also would be 10 major principles of Dickian Gnostic revelation. 1, the creator of this world is demented. 2, the world is not as it appears. In order to hide the evil in it, a delusive evil, obscuring it and the deranged deity. 3, there is another, better realm of God, and all our efforts are to be directed toward returning there, bringing it here. 4, our actual lives stretch thousands of years back, and we can be made to remember our origin in the stars. 5, each of us has a divine counterpart, unfallen, who can reach a hand down to us to awaken us. This other personality is the authentic waking self. The one we have now is asleep and minor. We are, in fact, asleep, and in the hands of a dangerous magician disguised as a good god, the deranged creator deity. The bleakness, the evil and pain in this world, the fact that it is a deterministic prison controlled by the demented creator, causes us willingly to split with the reality principle early in life, and so to speak, willingly fall asleep in delusion. 6. You can pass from the delusional prison world into the peaceful kingdom if the true good God places you under his grace and allows you to see reality through his eyes. 7. Christ gave, rather than received, revelation. He taught his followers how to enter the kingdom while still alive, where other mystery religions only bring about amnesis, knowledge of it at the other time in the other realm, not here. He causes it to come here and is the living agency to the sole good God, i.e. the Logos. 8. Probably the real, secret Christian church still exists, long underground, with the living Corpus Christi as its head or ruler, the members absorbed into it. Through participation in it, they probably have vast, seemingly magical powers. 9. The division into two times, good and evil, and two realms, good and evil, will abruptly end with a victory for the good time here, as the presently invisible kingdom separates and becomes visible. We cannot know the date. 10. During this time, we are on the sifting bridge being judged according to which power we give allegiance to. The deranged creator demiurge of this world, or the one good God and his kingdom, who we know through Christ. To know these 10 principles of Gnostic Christianity is to court disaster. Now, anyone who's studied Gnosticism will notice that there isn't too much, as far as I'm concerned, of a difference between Dickian Gnosticism and Gnosticism, Gnosticism proper. Now, to say Gnosticism proper is pretty tricky. Any scholar of alternative religion will tell you that, alongside the fact that when we speak of the Gnostics, I mean, if you were to read the Gnostic Bible, there's now a fairly big edition, but there's also Elaine Pagel's Gnostic Gospels, there's the Gnostic Gospels, there's the Gnostic Bible. The Gnostic Bible itself is around 900 pages and contains a mass of different documents written around the time of early Christianity, which purport to alter the understanding of Christianity towards something else. I mean, but there would also be those, I would argue, that would include within Gnosticism, the broad understanding of Gnosticism, the Manichaeans, different understandings of the Demiurge, different understandings of the Fall. You might also say, well, Origen closes in on a Gnosticism, Tertullian closes in on a Gnosticism. So that word is helpful, it's directional, it points us towards a direction. But I think in general, if to say, look, try to find one key tenet of Gnosticism, it is the splitting. It is the idea that there is a good, there is the absolute God above all things, the good God. Then there is the demiurge who created the material. This is very rough, but then there is the demiurge, almost in a way, the lower God who created this material world that we are in, the phenomenal world, quote unquote, for Dick, I think, reality. Now, how it is via Gnosticism that one could then come to have a relationship from the world of the demiurge, which is born of pain, of suffering, of evil, which Gnostics would read the God of the Old Testament as the demiurge. And then when we move through to the New Testament, what we find via Christ is a way from the revelation of Christ to have a relationship with the God, right? So how is it? Well, that's a relationship with Sophia. Sophia snuck a spark of divine light, the divine spark, into the world of the demiurge, the physical reality of suffering, which is within us all. We can all find that. And I think what's happening within Valis is that this pink beam of light experience is Dick's place, his point in time, his place where he is given access, given entry into a relationship with the divine spark. He's given a relationship with the true God. Now, this brings in two other key elements, which are, one isn't so difficult to understand, which is the black iron prison, which I say it's not too difficult to understand. So to quote Valis on the Black Iron Prison, once, in a cheap science fiction novel, Fat had come across a perfect description of the Black Iron Prison, but set in the far future. So if you superimpose the past, ancient Rome, over the present, California in the 20th century, and superimpose the far future world of the android Crimea River over that, you got the Empire as the supra or trans-temporal constant. Everyone who had ever lived was literally surrounded by the iron walls of the prison. They were all inside it. None of them knew it. So the Dickian Gnosticism is the belief that the material world, which is an alteration or just a simply a reappropriation, a retelling, how it is that Sophia has to get this through to us in the modern day. The Dickian Gnosticism is the belief that the material world, the black iron prison, which for Philip K. Dick, if I get the dates right, is really in cahoots with the Empire, which is instantiates itself in 70 AD, And then 1974, coincidentally, is when it ends, and you can now have this entry once again. Anyway, it's the belief that the material world, the Black Iron Prison we inhabit, is false and was created by a malevolent god. In some interpretations, the god of the Old Testament, the Demiurge, while the path to salvation is through understanding this false reality and coming to know the true hidden god, which is the sophiological, the sneaking in of the divine spark. Black Iron Prison then is what we would call, I think it's not a stretch to say, it's what we call reality. It's the without seeming coy and lazy, it's the going to work, it's the grind, it's what many would call in Philip K. Dick's day the system, the lockdown, I mean it is absolutely a prison. It is what we might consider to be normality, but when we bring that through to and sew it into an understanding of Gnosticism, we would also see that, you know, he talks about the dates of 70 AD through to 1974 AD. That it also has a relationship with the church, with dogmatics, with an understanding that what has happened to the early Christian church has been a bastardization, and is leading people away, and is leading people actually deeper into that prison, deeper into capital R reality, deeper into the real. And in fact, in the Tractatus Cryptica Scriptura, point 18, real time ceased in 70 CE with the fall of the temple at Jerusalem. It began again in 1974 CE. The intervening period was a perfect, spurious interpolation aping the creation of the mind. The empire never ended. But in 1974, a cipher was sent out as a signal that the age of iron was over. The cipher consisted of two words, King Felix, which refers to the happy or rightful king. Now, one thing I'd like to bring in here, that I think this is where Dick's humility is very important, is actually once again to refer to Gurdjieff, George Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff, when he wrote his Beelzebub's Tales to his grandson, wrote that as a holy book. And he makes the point in it early on that holy books have a context, they have a time, and they have a context, and time has a context. I mean, this is one of the great problems we've had with the Bible, the Old and the New Testaments compiled together as the Christian Bible. One of the great problems of it is interpretation. You know, and as the years go by, you know, anyone who's been alive for even 30 years can see events that happened when they were, say, 10, and see that they're already being skewed, and that's just a 20-year period. And so over the course of 2,000 years, or let's say 1,700, the when the Bible really begins to spread out as a formed document after the councils of Nicaea, etc., when that begin, you know, what's happening over 1,700 years? Gurdjieff calls this wiseacring, you know, like a long game of Chinese whispers. And if we take one example, for instance, the notion of hell, well, we have a very firm aesthetic appreciation of what hell means now. You know, this comes from films, it comes from books, it comes from Dante. It also comes from a huge period of medievalist Christianity, which really solidified that version of hell. And yet, many scholars would argue, when you go back to the New Testament, and the person who argues, who talks of hell more than anyone else, Jesus Christ, well, you go back to the etymology and the translation of that word, what he's really talking about is Gehenna, which was a flaming trash pile that he was referring to. Many scholars would argue this, and many would argue against it, but it was a flaming trash pile that he was just referring to as something, as a symbolic reference of what would happen to one's soul. Whether or not there's a literalist or allegorical interpretation, that's up to someone else. But we have 1,700 years of context, completely, in Gurdjieff's terms, wiseacring it all over the place, so we can never really get to the root of the matter. You know, the notion of being translated from Koine Greek into maybe Latin and then back into English, everything becomes lost. So Gurdjieff then argues, well, you need, holy books have their time, they have their context. And he would then say, you know, that the Quran has its time, its place, its context, which eventually fades away because you can't connect yourself back to it. And there's more and more of me. You know, there's the Hermetica from Hermes Trismegistus. There is Beelzebub's Tales of His Grandson. There is The Book of the Law from Aleister Crowley. There is Isis Unveiled from Blavatsky. And many of these books, which are given to a certain place and a certain time, for the people of that time to get in to connect to the way they understand the world to get through, right? Whatever, however symbolically you want to understand these things, it's a way for the people of that time to read a certain thing which is going to help them understand the dynamics in their own way, in their own context, in their own place. I think Valis is another example. It is a 1980s, very short appreciation of whatever you might consider a holy book to be. It's that which the message and the teachings of allow certain people in a certain place and a certain time to gel with them and to understand them in an intuitive, contextual way to break through, to have a relationship with the outside, to have a truthful relationship, to move through. One thing that's interesting that Philip K. Dick is doing is that he's bringing in the contextual conversations of our day to do with mental health, to do with insanity, to do with irreality, to do with how conceptions have come in, which completely changed from medieval periods or early Christian periods, and allowing us to see that, you know, those themselves, the black iron prison is something that locks down. It doesn't say these are options. It doesn't say these are alternative realities or alternative spiritualities. Reality and irreality. No, that isn't real. Get away from it. It's fantasy. It's imagination. You are insane. You know, that's wrong. There's a the black iron prison for Dick pushes a language not of alternatives, not of difference, and not of investigation or intrigue, which I think if someone could truly open themselves to that, you wouldn't become ill, you wouldn't become mad. It locks down. It says, this is certain, this is real. You know, let's think about it. Reality, sanity, these are all synonymous with stability and certainty in modern nomenclature. But, you know, this is the questions that Dickian Gnosticism is drawing in, is to draw in the language of the day and how we talk about these things to then question it. And so this, for me, is what Valis is. The story, the tale is much like the tale of spiritual figures, such as Hermes, such as Christ. You are to follow that in an allegorical form to understand it, to begin to understand the Dickian Gnosticism. And I think the fact that his exegesis doesn't come to some conclusion is because he understands it is always becoming. It is always happening. There isn't going to be a point when this stops. The only point where it could stop is within a contextual framework where, this book works for me. Okay, this is the one that you know, we can think about. The true God, the demiurge, and the divine light. I mean, these are three very deep allegories and three very deep realities. I'm not saying these aren't real things, but the language, the context, and the time plays a role within them, which allows a certain person in a certain context to open them up. And you find things that work for you to make things click. And I think for many people, Valis will be the book that can do that. But of course, there's a conversation to madness and insanity that will come from that. And the fact the exegesis doesn't really finish or find a conclusion, as I was saying, is because of that process can't end. The context is always changing. In a way, the empire is always evolving, to use Dickian terms. The Black Iron Prison, people have to, you know, as Gurdjieff needed to bring him in, I think there's a deep relation there, to bring him in. To escape prison, you have to first realize you're in prison. Well, the prison is always transforming throughout time. So to evolve that saying, to escape prison, you have to first realize you're in prison. To escape prison, you first have to realize you're in prison, which means you have to understand what prison might look like in your day, which is very, very difficult when we move into the so-called postmodern era, where prisons and authority structures and authority figures all become our friends, and there isn't so much of a clear dialectic between master and slave or superiority, etc. Everything is becoming interspersed, and it's very, very dangerous. But this is a very interesting sort of a shock to the system guide to allow one to begin to look into that splitting, and at the same time read a great piece of science fiction if you wish to read it that way. But I think the probably the best way to define it is science hyperstition, is almost chaos magic hyperstition. Chaos magic fiction, too. In the same way that the texts of Kenneth Grant and Dion Fortune, these mystical fictions that they write, actually have a purpose to open something up in the reader while you're reading it to experience reality differently for them in a magical sense. For Philip K. Dick, I mean, I think the form is synonymous with the likes of Dion Fortune, etc., in these older mystical fictional texts, which are there to open something up in you and experience the world differently, Arthur Machen being another example. Philip K. Dick is one of the first to write a science fiction novel dealing with reality in such a way that it's attempting to do something with your psyche, do something with your reality, which then opens up the possibility for you to experience this yourselves. So, Philip K. Dick's Valis. Fact, fiction, and a textbook. When to read it? Read it when you haven't had much sleep. Read it when you've drunk way too much coffee. Read it on public transport. Read it around people. Read it in hustling, bustling places. Really throw yourselves into it. Really allow yourselves to have a little glimpse of the madness. The so-called madness, the so-called insanity. That's my little review and my little comment on Valis and Dickian Gnosticism. It's not necessarily a difficult read. It's well written, simply written, but it's at times dense in form. You could sit with certain lines of it for a long time, and then at the back you have this Tractates Cryptica Scriptura, which you really study. And then from this you have also have the full book, The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick, and then once again a shout out to DickianGnosticism.wordpress.com, where you could go and really delve into this worldview. But that's my little review of Valis. I hope you found that enjoyable. Thanks very much for listening.